John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, June 7, 2012. A Palestinian prisoner on hunger strike is at risk of dying. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers attack several communities in the West Bank. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli settlers attacked several Palestinian communities in the West Bank on Thursday morning. Settlers attacked Palestinian vehicles in the south of Nablus and threw stones at the vehicles. Ghassan Douglas, head of the settlement files in the north of the West Bank, said that settlers from Gilad settlement ambushed vehicles near the town of Hawara and attacked the vehicles by throwing stones. He pointed out that many settlers organized themselves in the south of the city to attack Palestinian residents and their vehicles. In Al-Khadr village south of Bethlehem, eyewitnesses reported that settlers from Al-Aizer settlement uprooted and stole metal pillars and barbed wire that demarcated the land boundaries of many farmers in the village. Ahmed Salah, coordinator of the Popular Committee Against the War in Settlements in Al-Khadr, said that the land owners were surprised on Thursday morning when they realized their barbed wire and metal pillars were uprooted, as it covered an area of around 2.5 acres. Pamphlets found on the farmers' land belong to the Israeli group of Women in Green, which is led by the extremist Nadia Matar. This group attacks Palestinian property with the aim to push Palestinians off the land so settlers can seize it. Furthermore, settlers of Maon and Havat Maon settlement east of Yatta and the south Hebron attacked farmers on Thursday morning in the east of Yatta and forbade them from harvesting their wheat and barley. Ratib al-Jabour, coordinator of the Popular Committee Against the War in Settlements in southern Hebron, said that settlers escorted by soldiers attacked the farmers and shepherds and prevented them from harvesting their lands and replant what the settlers had destroyed a few days ago. In other news, an independent doctor who visited football player Mahmoud Sersek said that Sersek is at risk of death and must be hospitalized immediately. Sersek has been on hunger strike for 84 days and is being held at Ramleh Prison Clinic. He had not been allowed an independent doctor visit till last Wednesday. Physicians for Human Rights Israel were finally able to send a doctor to visit a Sersak on Wednesday after petitioning an Israeli court for permission. The doctor reported that the prisoner has been losing consciousness and suffers from memory lapses, and that he suffers pulse disruptions that would endanger his life. A Sersak has been imprisoned in Israel without trial for almost 3 years when he was part of a football team trying to cross the Beit Hanun checkpoint at the northern Gaza Strip. He decided to remain on hunger strike despite the deal reached between the prisoners and the Israeli prison authorities. He is demanding his immediate release. That's all from IMEMC News. This was Thursday, June 7th, daily roundup news from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kutsis and me, George Rishmaoui.
Just days before Egyptians go to the polls in the final round of their nation's first competitive presidential election, a three-judge panel convicted ousted Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and his former interior minister, Habib El Adli, of being accessories to murder of pro-democracy protesters last spring. Both men were sentenced to life in prison. But the judge's decision to dismiss corruption charges against Mr. Mubarak and his sons set off major protests in Cairo's Tahrir Square and other cities across Egypt. Those protesting were also angered with the court for acquitting many Mubarak regime officials who were directly involved in the orders given to police who killed more than 840 protesters and wounded some 6,000. Many legal observers predicted that Mubarak's conviction and life sentence would likely be overturned on appeal. Candidates seeking votes in Egypt's presidential runoff election on June 16th and 17th attempted to spin the court verdict to their benefit. But with so many Egyptians viewing Mubarak's sentence as a sham, the advantage appeared to shift to the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate, Mohamed Morsi. His opponent, Ahmad Shafiq, Mubarak's last prime minister before his ouster, is campaigning on a law and order platform. Your reporter spoke with Saif Dana, associate professor of sociology and international studies at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. He discusses the upcoming final round in Egypt's presidential election and the recent court verdict on Hosni Mubarak.
Well, Scott, the issue is not only that Mubarak's sons and actually, which is more serious, six senior officials in the Interior Ministry were acquitted in this case. But the issue is that even the sentence, the life sentence that was given to Mubarak and his Interior Minister are going to be subject for a lengthy appeal, which could actually result in another acquittal for Mubarak in the future. Especially the chief persecutor did not really provide enough evidence in the case, which allowed the judge, or enabled the judge, basically, to provide acquittal for Mubarak on the corruption cases and for the senior interior ministry officials who were actually responsible for the oppression and for the killing. Basically, they were the Mubarak's main men on the ground during the revolt. So the problem is not only that some people were acquitted, but even Mubarak and his interior minister could be acquitted in the appeal process. Basically, the judgment in this trial were really very political, and most of the responsibility should be held by the chief prosecutor, who is, by the way, like the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, a Mubarak official. So he belongs to the old regime that wasn't really removed after the revolution. So basically, he did not take this case serious. The evidence that were provided in the court and throughout the trial really were not sufficient to warrant the death penalty that most of the Egyptians are asking for, or even a life sentence for the rest of the individuals in this case. So some of the demands now on the streets and in the Tahrir Square are to remove the chief prosecutor in Egypt and to have a retrial for Mubarak and his senior officials and his sons, or although his sons are still in prison for another case, insider trading, which is a new case that they have against them right now.
Professor Dana,
In Egypt, they will be holding the presidential runoff election on June 16th and 17th, pitting the Islamic Brotherhood candidate Mohamed Morsi against former prime minister in the Mubarak regime, Ahmed Shafiq. What are the major issues that Egyptian voters will be confronting when they go to the polls on June 16th and 17th?
Well, as many Egyptian commentators basically said, this scenario that led to having both candidates in the runoff really is the worst case scenario because there isn't much really difference politically between the two. And primarily, there isn't really any difference economically. Both adopt a neoliberal agenda for Egypt. And that's why it's the worst case scenario. Although on the case of Shafiq, he would work to reproduce the old regime and or revive the old regime, basically. But there is one difference that most commentators actually focus on, despite the similarities in politics and economics, and that's the criminality aspect. Because Shafiq was actually the prime minister during some of the bloodiest days of the Egyptian revolution, and therefore most people hold him responsible for a major part of the killing. That's not something that they can accuse the Muslim Brotherhood with, but the outcome would be very unpredictable because of many rebels on the ground and activists might actually abstain from casting their votes, and that might affect the outcome. We don't know how much are going to abstain.
Professor Saif Dana, what is your impression of the young revolutionaries who sparked the uprising last spring in Egypt and their future? Many of them must be disappointed with the two final candidates in the runoff election, but do you feel that their movement will continue to move forward and they will continue to push Egyptian society and politics in their direction?
I think, yes, they will continue. I don't expect that the Egyptian situation will actually come to a calm soon, even if Morsi was elected. If Shafiq was elected, definitely the street, we will continue to see protests in the street. Since the Muslim Brotherhood won almost 37% of the votes in the parliamentary election back in November, we're now witnessing a very different political landscape in Egypt. Basically, we have three major groups in Egypt, and the largest is actually a pro-revolution group, but unfortunately the votes were divided between three or four candidates instead of having one candidate that represents the revolution. So in less than 1 year, we're actually seeing a different, radically different political landscape, but we have a major bloc, and now they're realizing that they actually constitute a strong force on the ground, and they are going to use it, and I'm sure they will use it, and that will actually limit the power or the practices of the president in the future, whoever the president is, whether Morsi or Shafiq.
That was Saif Dana, Associate Professor of Sociology and International Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. Find more news and analysis on the Egyptian revolution and this month's election on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan, yesterday, two NATO soldiers were killed when the Taliban shot down their helicopter in the eastern part of Afghanistan. Logar Province, Afghanistan. Yesterday, Afghan officials and villagers reported that 18 people, including women and children, were killed in a NATO airstrike in the southeast. An AP reporter said he saw the bodies of five women, seven children, and six men loaded into vans and driven to the provincial capital for a protest against the airstrike. The people killed by the airstrike had gathered for a wedding that NATO mistook for an insurgent gathering. This is not the first time that NATO or their snitches have made that particular mistake. Kandahar, Afghanistan, yesterday. At least 22 people were killed by a double suicide bombing outside a bazaar near the big NATO base there. That bazaar is a known parking area and rest stop for trucks and NATO convoys. Some of these drivers were among the dead. Over 50 people were wounded by the blasts. Libya, yesterday, a U.S. diplomatic mission was bombed. The IED was dropped from a passing car. Many say this is retaliation for the killing of Al-Qaeda's number two leader in a recent drone strike. Mr. Barack Obama, you can't win this war. any more than George W. Bush was able to win in Iraq or Nixon was able to win in Vietnam. Now is the time to throw in the towel, bring all the troops home today. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah.
On the 4th of June, Occupy Our Home staged a multi-pronged invasion of the Loan Modification Office of J.P. Morgan Chase. One group, including retired D.C. EMT paramedic Deborah Harris, walked into the office to demand that Chase and Freddie Mac cease and desist efforts to foreclose on her home. Another protested in the office, and a third contingent covered them by storming the lobby after marching over from Freddie Mac. Go.
Wow.
Here we go. Two groups
protesting or speaking. The smaller group, which is the first group, is inside the office of the manager's office negotiating.
Oh yeah, there's.
And the second group is in Chase Bank's office, just picketing, I guess.
And then there's a
sweet. And so all this is a diversion that covered them.
Yes.
Sweet.
For about 2 hours now.
For about 2 hours now.
While JP Morgan
continues to lose money,
they continue to ignore
our friend
Deborah.
So I think
it's important
that we stay here
until she has the modification,
because we know
the banks
only care about Jamie Dimon and his BFFs.
Police made no arrests, even though occupiers blocked the doors. And finally, after about 2 hours out front, with protesters having entered the lobby and a second group of protesters having been upstairs, after 3 hours of waiting, Deborah Harris finally got her meeting with the officials of J.P. Morgan Chase. They agreed to work with her to modify her mortgage. They better not try to go back on that deal, or Occupy's gonna be back.
Guys, form a baby!
Shh! Sit down and they talk to me. Where they stand, that they will notify Freddie Mac and tell them about what's going on, and how they will try to help me out in order to get me a modification and everything. So that's what I believe that they would tell me. So I told them, don't be making promises to me, because I've had to wait since 2009 to get something done. And I also found out a lady in the office said that if she had known that my house had been in notification in 2009, she said, why did they didn't tell you that they had an office down here that I could have came down here and got that modification done in 2009. I've been in my house ever since 2009, December 2009, and now they was going to wait until this year to put me out of my house. So Chase was saying that they want to do an investigation. They're going to call the lawyer for Freddie Mac and find out what's going on so they can try to work with me and keep me abreast every day of what's going on. That's the only thing I can do, y'all. Thank you for everyone that's come out for my support.
Thank you.
The only thing we can do is just wait to see exactly what's going on. I told them, please don't promise me. Don't promise me that you're going to do something. Do it. No, that's all I want you to do. Wasn't for y'all being here, Occupy Home DC being here, they would have brushed me off. they would have not paid me any attention. They would have just said, well, she's just another little D.C. resident that's trying to get her home.
In case you couldn't hear that, what Deborah is worried about is that those crooks at J.P. Morgan Chase will deal with her only long enough to get Occupy out of their office, then go back on their promise to modify her mortgage. But they better think twice about that, because if they play that game, Occupy will be back. On the 4th of June, Occupy Our Homes invaded and then protested outside the office of J.P. Morgan Chase, demanding that they modify a mortgage held by retired D.C. paramedic and EMT Deborah Harris instead of foreclosing on her. She suffered a career-ending injury, and the thanks she got for 23 years of saving lives was a threat of foreclosure until Occupy Our Homes held the bank's feet to the fire and forced them to agree to work with her to modify her loan. While Deborah was inside haggling with J.P. Morgan Chase and protesters blocked the doors from outside, D.C.'s own Reverend Hagler told everyone how people of faith finding the homes of banking executives and CEOs were able to force the big banks to work with the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America to modify tens of thousands of mortgages.
There's been a group called the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, or NACA. And we've been moving all across the country doing home save events. And when I say home save events, it's because we've been moving working people into being able to purchase a home the right way. When I say the right way meant that we force the lenders to pay closing costs, and we basically put people in their homes a percentage point below the market at 100% loan to value. And they were exempt from private mortgage insurance. They were exempt from all the other scams that happened. And the reality is all of our folks basically stayed in their homes. We're safe in their homes. And so we moved to deal with this meltdown by doing modifications. We left Washington, D.C. about 4 weeks ago. We saw over 58,000 people at the convention center here in Washington, D.C. Then we went after that to Richmond. We saw over 50,000 people in the Richmond area being there a weekend. We went to Atlanta. We saw 70,000 people in Atlanta. We're going to San Antonio. San Antonio, and then Cleveland after that. And basically what we've been doing is taking people and saying that give us a budget of what you can afford. If your property's underwater, we have exclusive contracts with the lenders that we can basically take principal off the table and lower the interest rate so that somebody can fit in and be able to comfortably stay in their home and that be fixed for the rest of the mortgage. We did that. How did we do that? Well, it didn't start out by sitting down and simply having a conversation with the lenders. We found out where some of the CEOs live. And we went to their homes. And they tried to block us from some of their summer homes in Long Island.
Ah.
We rented rafts and got on their property by way of sea.
Yeah.
We wanted to let them know that they could not run away from our moral demands. And so one by one, the lenders signed contracts with us. Not because they love us, but because we did the research. We found out where their children went to school. We found out what country club they hung out in. We found out where their mama lived. And we showed up, and we showed up, and we hounded them, and we made it personal. It wasn't about Chase. It was about Debbie Diamond.
Yes.
It wasn't about any of the other corporations. It was personally about those CEOs. Why was it personally? Because they made it personal. Yes. They made it personal when they put people out of their homes. Those are real names and faces. And so we had to take the battle and make it a very personal battle in order for these folks to understand that we have taken taking this seriously, and it's personal, and we're going to deal with it in a personal fashion. Now, the fact is, I'll say that as we continue to do the advocacy, because NACA's an advocacy organization and you're an advocacy group, continue to do the advocacy. That is needed. We got to keep this lifted up. But also, as you know, people who are having difficulty, send them to our website, NACA.com, NACA.com. And under tabs that says Home Save, they can begin the process of getting their mortgages modified and affordable.
That's what I call getting results. And it all worked because the CEOs and senior executives of the banks really didn't want to have protesters from the churches coming out to their homes, coming to their weddings, and other high-profile public events. Direct action gets the goods, squeaky wheel gets the grease. Don't let the bankers intimidate you into giving up your home. Organize and get together with your neighbors and those you trust the most. Hold their feet to the fire, and together we can defend our homes. On the 5th of June, just before 9 a.m., U.S. Marshals showed up at 917 Maryland Avenue Northeast to evict Dawn Butler after JPMorgan Chase foreclosed on her landlord. It would be this team's first and last eviction that day.
Who do you serve?
Who do you protect?
Who do you serve?
Who do you protect?
Who do you serve? Who do you protect?
Banks got bailed out!
We got sold out!
Banks got bailed out!
We got sold out!
Banks got bailed out!
We got sold out!
This eviction is illegal! This eviction is illegal!
It wasn't Miss Butler being foreclosed on, but her landlord. This was their second attempt to evict Miss Butler. They gave up on April the 2nd when Occupy Our Homes got there first. When the marshals arrived, they were in for a surprise. Occupy activists were not only back, but had barricaded the doors with milk crates and rope. They had to stop and wait for more than an hour. They brought in a backup team armed with automatic weapons, plus a police dog who was apparently used only as a threat. One of the marshals brandished a taser but did not fire, while another stood around with an M16 assault rifle. First, the marshals had to clear dozens of occupiers from the front lawn. As they did, they started getting rough, with several of them violently trying to lever one protester by the pole of a banner while forcing back the press and putting their hands in inappropriate places.
She's doing your job!
As they finished clearing the yard, the marshals started in on the activists holding the steps. Activists were violently grabbed and physically thrown down the concrete stairs. U.S. Marshals do not have jurisdiction to make arrests during evictions, so they were limited to using force and violence to get past Occupy activists defending Dawn's home. When they attacked the barricade, they got another surprise. Macho, big man cops thought they could just pull it down and it would collapse. Not exactly. The ropes held the milk crates together, and a cloud of milk crates collapsed onto the marshals.
U.S. Marshals have just torn down a blockade made of plastic milk cartons. Underneath that blockade are two of the last remaining Occupy D.C. protesters. They have chained themselves to that blockade, and the marshals have just torn down not only the blockade, but also the front door. They are surrounded by dozens of angry Occupy D.C. protesters.
At one point in the video shot by WAMU, it looks like the marshals were trying to swim in a choppy sea of waving, flailing milk crates. Three activists were chained to this barricade. All three of them and one of the marshals as well were injured by the reckless conduct of the evictors. The U.S. marshals were extraordinarily brutal in this stage of the eviction. One Occupy activist was choked unconscious by the evictors and left unresponsive on the sidewalk. Those who had been chained to the barricade were thrown down the masonry staircase. Both a door and a window were smashed by the evictors, who left the house boarded up. One of the cops trying to wrangle the milk crates can be seen in another YouTube video keeping his right hand on his gun while trying to manage the flying crates with his left. The marshals were so aggressive in trying to remove the barricade, they smashed both a front door and a window in the process, and a piece of it scored a direct hit on another U.S. Marshal, leaving him sitting on the ground nursing a head wound. Oh well, what comes around goes around after throwing and choking protesters.
Oh shit, Lash got injured.
They threw him down the stuff.
Alright, I'll be right back. I'm gonna run around. We got many injured over here. We got one seriously injured. That was Mark. I think he's unconscious.
That would be the defender. One of the U.S. Marshals choked until he passed out. This was a dogged defense against an illegal eviction. The U.S. Marshals had to cancel 9 other evictions because the intense resistance at 917 Maryland Avenue Northeast took all morning to overcome. If every eviction was resisted like this, there would have to be 10 times less evictions. Again, this eviction took place in defiance of D.C. law. The bankers at J.P. Morgan Chase were not foreclosing on Dawn Butler, they were foreclosing on her landlord. Under D.C. law, tenants have the right of first refusal to buy a foreclosed property. Both Ms. Butler and her landlord had agreed to this, but the loan sharks of J.P. Morgan Chase refused to cooperate. Although evictions are normally scheduled by the U.S. Marshals in advance, I find it interesting that J.P. Morgan Chase evicts one person defended by Occupy DC's Occupy Our Homes branch less than a full day after their office at 1350 I Street was occupied, forcing them to put foreclosure proceedings against a retired DC paramedic defended by Occupy on hold. They agreed to work to modify her mortgage after she holed up in her loan modification office for 3 hours, backed by Occupy protesters both inside and out. If J.P. Morgan Chase wants to play rough, maybe they should review tapes of what happened to the Koch brothers defending the American Dream Conference last November at the Convention Center to see just how nasty things can get. And while they're at it, let them talk to anybody who's ever done business with Huntington Life Sciences. On the 31st of May, several hundred D.C. residents and union members gathered at 801 New Jersey Avenue Northwest, one of the proposed sites for Walmart in D.C. They marched from there to Walmart's D.C. lobbying headquarters at 701 8th Street Northwest. The star float in the parade was a truck-mounted bed with D.C. flag covers, and on top was someone dressed D.C. Mayor Gray and someone wearing a Walmart smiley face.
I am a yellow black gentleman.
Meanwhile, people dressed as council members Brown, Bowser, and Alexander passed out piles of fake campaign cash that doubled as anti-Walmart leaflets. When the parade arrived at Walmart's 701 8th Street D.C. offices, here's what people had to say.
Retail is one of the few sectors in the country that is still growing and creating jobs. People don't get rich on it, but people like the giant and fake like me buy homes, put their kids in college. Walmart can't say that. Walmart can't do that. The reason that guy in Safeway can do that, the workers there, because they have unions. Walmart is a union buster. They don't allow unions. They don't allow their workers a free choice.
Vice President, National Organization of Women. Amen. All right.
Yeah. Thank you. Hi, I'm Alyssa Lessem, and I'm here with the National Organization for Women. I'm the membership vice president, and I just want to let you all know, NOW is here with you. From Seattle to Alabama, from New York to Chicago, NOW women are on the ground, ready, able, grounded, with our sign, ready to take a stand against Walmart. But I also want to let you know, this is not a new fight for us. We declared Walmart a merchant of shame in 2002 when we found out that they had discriminatory practices against women.
And no advantage the representative's reply was, oh yes ma'am, we cover experimental, but Walmart's policies don't. You sold me cheesy, substandard health insurance. After several months and numerous rounds of radiation treatments went by, I finally went back to work to overhear the manager's stress in a meeting that our store was to get rid of 100 employees. It was very clear that his goal was to save on wages and benefits by hiring part-time employees.
Mr. Mayor, hundreds of people came out on the last day of May asking you to put an end to those backroom deals with Walmart. If you were to be Walmart's back door into the city, you just might turn out to be a one-term mayor just like Adrian Fenty.
As Europe searches for a continent-wide solution for its gathering debt crisis, the United States economy is feeling the effects of the recession across the Atlantic. President Obama recently blamed Europe's economic difficulties in part for the recent disappointing jobs report in the U.S. The European Union, comprised of 17 nations using the euro currency and 10 that don't, is a larger economic bloc than either the U.S. or China. Germany's Chancellor, Angela Merkel, has been the continent's strongest advocate of austerity policies, asserting that it's the only cure for expanding debt and putting the European economy back on the right track. But growing discontent among the people of Greece, Spain, Italy, and other nations who have seen severe budget cuts, the slashing of social programs, and a lowering of their standard of living have been fighting back, both in the streets and now at the ballot box. The strong showing of Syriza, the Greek coalition of the Radical Left Party in the most recent election, and a possible first-place finisher in a second-round vote on June 17th, along with the victory of French socialist candidate François Hollande over conservative President Nicolas Sarkozy in May, signals to many observers a shift to the left and away from austerity across Europe. However, it remains to be seen whether the so-called Troika, made up of the European Union, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank, will change course, in recognition that austerity policies have thus far failed to turn around the continent's weak economies and rising unemployment rate. Your reporter spoke with Richard Wolff, professor of economics at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs. Just back from visiting Europe, Wolff discusses how austerity policies have fueled the Eurozone crisis and prospects that public resistance will force leaders there to adopt a pro-growth strategy.
As the troubles in Europe come back and infect us through the market, and we now face the situation where the so-called recovery that people were talking about over the last 5 months is shown to be not a recovery at all. The numbers released by the government last Friday about the labor situation, the unemployment situation, is grim. The numbers released about the factory employment in the country are grim. And I think we're seeing a very fundamental crisis that neither the Europeans nor the Americans know how to bring to an end. We are in the fifth year of it. And in Europe, the policies that have been followed, which are called austerity policies, cutting back government spending, have not solved the problem. They've, if anything, made it worse. And we're seeing a wholesale, massive political movement, yes, in Greece and France, but very strongly in many other countries, Italy, Spain, and so on. You're seeing a movement to the left politically as the masses of people are saying, you can't continue to do this. You can't subject us to an economic crisis that hurts us, that makes the rich even richer than they were before. You can't then, on top of it, have the government bail them out and then say that we, the mass of people, have to pay the cost of those expensive bailouts, the benefits of which we never saw. And this never was a sustainable program. And I think the people running those societies, like those running the United States economy, are in for a very rough ride because it isn't going to work. And the deepening crisis is producing political changes on a scale we haven't seen in at least half a century.
There are many governments that have fallen as a result of this economic crisis in Europe. But I wonder, are some of these parties on the left who are challenging the austerity policy status quo, do they have solutions that they're offering that are viable ways out of the economic crisis and at the same time save the Eurozone from a demise that many people are concerned about? Even people in Greece want to remain in the Eurozone, want to use the euro as their currency, but are really opposed to the horrible devaluation of their standard of living at the same time.
You're quite right to ask the question, do they really have a worked-out alternative? I think, honestly, the answer to that is no, that they are clear only that the austerity policy of the current governments is a disaster and cannot be allowed to continue. When you push them, they say, well, what we're going to do is we're going to grow our way out of this dilemma. We're going to run deficits in the government in order to create jobs programs. You know, the real image of what they are proposing is a kind of rerun of what Franklin Roosevelt did here in the United States the last time we had a major crisis like this in the 1930s. And will that work? I don't think anyone knows. Will they even have a chance to do that? That's not clear either, because if the big banks and the credit markets do not allow them to have a chance to do a non-austerity program, then these societies are going to fall apart, and the euro is going to dissolve, and you're going to have a very, very hard time. And before any of your listeners get the wrong idea, that would be a disaster not only for the Europeans to go through, but the impact on the United States will make our economic crisis now markedly worse than it already is.
Richard, on your recent trip to Europe, what kind of hope have you brought back with you that the movements, the anti-austerity movements in Europe are gaining traction with the public and may in the near future pose a greater challenge to those folks promoting austerity?
Well, it's clear. Across Europe, in every country, really, without exception, that left-wing forces are growing, are much more confident, much more hopeful than they have been in decades. That is, they see, and I think they're quite right, that the 30 years of celebration of the decline of socialism and the decline of communism and the supposed victory of capitalism, all that has now been thrown into the most profound questioning and challenging everywhere. And I think that's true here in the United States. If the leftists in Greece, who are the furthest along, were to win the election in 2 weeks and become the number one party, and Mr. Tsipras, the Greek leader of that party, would then become the prime minister, then you would see a major straw in the wind. You still have to remember that Greece is a very small country, a very small part of Europe. But if the French situation keeps going the way it is, if Mrs. Merkel keeps losing elections in Germany, which she has been, if there's a big enough push to the left, then I think you will see the Keynesian effort made again as the lesser evil, just the way it was on the part of Roosevelt in the 1930s.
That was Richard Wolff, professor of economics at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs and author of the new book, Occupy the Economy. Find links to more news and commentary on the Eurozone crisis on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
30th of May, the National Park Service announced plans to use so-called sharpshooters from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to kill up to three-quarters of all deer at Rock Creek Park. They plan to shoot on winter nights, closing off sections of the park to make way for the slaughter. The USDA also shoots and poisons wolves and other predators out west to make cattle ranching more profitable. So killing animals comes easy to them. The Park Service says a population of about 80 deer per square mile is too many, and it may be unsustainable. The only thing is, that's coming from us humans, a species with a population density of about 6,000 per square mile in D.C., complaining that an 80 per square mile of some other species is too many. Such hypocrisy, and deer are not the only thing that can harm Rock Creek Park. They say deer are a hazard to motorists, but some say the same about pedestrians and bicyclists. In fact, if we can cull deer for eating too much of Rock Creek, why don't we cull SUVs for polluting the creek with oil and antifreeze and the air with exhaust? There are a lot more cars than deer in Rock Creek. Just what is the National Park Service smoking? To think the most destructive animal on earth, ourselves, has any jurisdiction whatsoever over deer, when there are 75 people for every deer on a population density basis around D.C. Okay? So the deer eat so much that the park is suffering. What do you think the huge amount of land that has to be cleared to support the meat-heavy U.S. diet is doing to the land as a whole? For that matter, runoff from lawn services, lawn chemicals, is probably doing more damage to Rock Creek than deer excrement ever will. It's time to get real and tell the pot to stop calling the kettle an iron casting.
West Virginia is one of the nation's biggest coal-producing states. Coal is transported from the southern Appalachian coalfields by truck, barge, and rail, and is often cleaned on site before being shipped to fuel the nation's power plants. But both the production and treatment of coal produce major health risks for local residents. Many residents adversely affected by the coal industry have been protesting for decades, especially against mountaintop removal coal mining, which involves blasting the tops off mountains to reach the coal seams underneath, then dumping the earth and rock in the valleys below. In late May, activists from Mountain Justice and Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, or RAMPS, organized two actions to disrupt coal business as usual, employing nonviolent civil disobedience to block 9 coal trucks and a coal barge. Then on Memorial Day, a group called Women Unite to End Mountaintop Removal gathered on the steps of the state capitol in Charleston and shaved their heads in protest. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Marilyn Mullins, a native of southern West Virginia, who describes some of the events in her life that led her to become an anti-coal activist, and discusses her idea behind the symbolic Memorial Day protest, where 12 women and some men shaved their heads.
Around the end of the 90s is when the mountaintop removal started where I lived, on both sides of the holla. So, you know, it's one mountain on one side, one on the other. They were pretty much blasting both of them. A lot of damage to our homes, a lot of dust, not just your typical brown dust, but this gray, white, almost powdery looking dust. Didn't really pay a whole lot of attention because I was a single mom and I was a full-time nursing student and still in the military. So I just kind of, life had me pretty busy. In 2001, we had a big flood. We had a heavy rain, and a lot of people there lost their homes. A lot of my friends, a lot of my family lost their homes. Everyone that lived there knows that it was because there was no topsoil or trees left on the mountain. So, you know, we'd had a lot of heavy rains before, but this is the first time that we'd had floods like that since, I think, like the early 1900s. And that kind of sparked another little, you know, interest in me to pay more attention. But in early 2004, my husband and I both got deployed out to California as medical people, taking care of some of the injured soldiers coming back from the war. And we were out there a couple years, and during that time, my house literally was blown off its foundation. I mean, it's completely, a big sinkhole dropped under it, and it shifted off the foundation, so we had to come home. And basically, the coal company refused to take any responsibility. I came back from the deployment in 2006, and I did not even go back to that area. I just left my house there for sale, and it sat empty for 5 years. Property values are horrible. And my husband and I moved to Raleigh County, which is also a mining county, but we moved to a more rural area, sort of out of the middle of all of it, because we were I say the lucky ones because we could afford to do that. Most people can't. But that's my connection. I started paying more attention to the news, some local activists getting arrested, and pretty much they shamed me. Well, I have to do something. I have to do more. So since that time, I've been trying to be more active and in fighting this.
Marilyn Mullins, there's been some recent activity to draw attention to the damage that coal mining and processing is doing in Appalachia. Can you describe those recent actions?
Some activists boarded a coal barge on the Kanawha River, chained themselves to it, had a banner. The banner says, "Coal leaves and the cancer stays." We have a lot of bad health effects because not only the burning of the coal, but the extraction process they use. And also some activists blocked an access road to one of the mountaintop removal sites on Kayford Mountain, stopping them being able to take equipment or take coal out.
In the past couple of years, some health studies have come out showing increased levels of both cancers and birth defects among residents living close to coal mining operations as compared to similar populations not living in coal country.
I guess the one that sticks out most in my mind is the study with the birth defects. You know, it shows much higher rates of people that live within a 50-mile radius even of an active mountaintop removal site. More neurological, more respiratory problems. You know, my children were small and breathed that dust for 3 years, and it really concerns me, you know. I did too. You know, what are the long-term effects? There was silicon in that blasting material and stuff that they use. But, you know, what the coal company's response was to the birth defect study was they didn't account for the inbreeding of the people here. Well, I've lived here all my life, and I've never had a cousin marry a cousin. That's just ridiculous.
So how did you come up with the idea of women shaving their heads in protest?
I guess I was just fed up. Back in January, February timeframe, I went to bed one night just so frustrated. And that happens. Sometimes you feel like you just have to either stop or you're going to lose your mind because it's so frustrating because nobody will listen, nobody that can do anything. I think I've been to maybe a DEP hearing or something, and, you know, the DEP is supposed to be on our side to protect the people, and they're not. Here in West Virginia, they're owned by the coal companies. And I just went to bed so upset, and I woke up in the middle of the night with this idea that, okay, I've got to do something. I can't quit. I can't keep talking because it's not doing any good. So what can I do to make a loud statement? And that just kind of came to me. I thought, well, you know, something that's really important to women here in the United States and our culture is their hair. So I'm going to take mine off in solidarity with our mountains being stripped of everything. I mean, they don't leave anything. They don't even leave the topsoil on these mountains. In solidarity with my people who are sick and dying and who have already passed away.
That was Marilyn Mullins of Women Unite to End Mountaintop Removal. For additional information on the environmental and health effects of the coal industry, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Lawyers for victims of oil pollution in the Ecuadorian rainforest have gone to court in Canada to enforce an $18 billion Ecuadorian court judgment against Chevron. Chevron has refused to pay the damage award, saying the plaintiff's case was riddled with bribery and fraud, and the judgment cannot be enforced in any court outside of Ecuador. The court filing in Ontario is one of several moves expected in coming weeks by the Ecuadorians who first filed a lawsuit against Texaco in the early 1990s. Chevron bought Texaco in 2001 and inherited its environmental liabilities. Ellen Lenksner, a lawyer for the plaintiffs, told the Financial Times that courts in Canada have a long history of recognizing foreign judgments from the United States and Latin America. The $18 billion judgment in Ecuador has put pressure on Chevron's top executives to reform its environmental practices. Activists from across the globe came to Chevron's shareholders meeting to confront management on environmental issues. These included American environmentalists concerned about natural gas fracking and Brazilian oil workers angry about a huge offshore oil spill. Some industry observers say that Chevron's ambitions in Latin America, especially in Brazil, could force the oil giant to agree to a fair settlement in Ecuador.